Hello, and welcome to this first February edition of Podularity, the online books programme that brings you authors and books in a pod. My name is George Miller, and my guest this week is Rog Glass. Last August, when I was in Glasgow, I visited Rog to talk about his biography of Scottish writer Alistair Gray, shortly before it was published. The 74-year-old novelist self-deprecatingly refers to himself as a fat, spectacled, balding, increasingly old Glasgow pedestrian. Nonetheless, his novel Lanark, published in 1981, is widely regarded as the most important work of Scottish fiction of the last century. In Will Self's opinion, Gray is possibly the greatest living writer in the UK today. Rog Glass is himself a published novelist, so I began by asking him how he came to write this unconventional biography.
I was an undergraduate at Strathclyde University. I just moved to Glasgow, having failed my A-levels, so not being able to go to Newcastle University. And I was working at a pub job in order to, you know, just in order to get by whilst being a student. And the pub that I was working in was Curlers in the West End, which was a very famous old pub that had just been turned into a student pub. And the landlord at the time was a huge Alistair Gray fan. And when he realised that Alistair was coming in occasionally for a quick pint or something, he was hugely excited by this, and he got lots of people within the pub reading his books, and I was one of them. And so Alistair came in one day, and I pushed everybody aside to go and serve him, and made an absolute hash of having a conversation with him, so much so that he downed his drink and left as quick as he could. But thankfully, he'd totally forgotten that by the time he came back in a couple of days later, and I just started again and made a slightly better job of it. And we got chatting over a number of days. He talked about a mural that used to be on the wall at Curlers that had lots of old Glaswegian writers and journalists on it. And we just chatted. And that was it for a good while, until by accident he became a professor on the Glasgow University creative writing course shortly after I'd been accepted onto it. By that point, I was a huge fan of his work, and given 7 options for tutors that I could have, I listed Alistair Gray both 1, 2, and 3, and basically demanded that they give him to me. So he helped me when I was just starting out as a writer. He wasn't a typical tutor, but he was very dedicated in his own way, although it often meant rewriting sections of my work in his style, which we thought about quite a lot. But I thought he was the most fascinating human being I'd ever met, never mind anything else to do with the work. And I just wanted to be, at the beginning, around him, because it was inspiring. And for somebody starting out to write, anything that drives you to continue and try and improve yourself is worthwhile. You slowly lose that fan's adoration after a while, and the relationship changes, as it did with us. And my work reached a stage where Alistair felt he'd passed on what he needed to, and that was the end of that, really. But around that time, he needed a secretary, and I was very, very keen to be given the job. In short, 3 years later, after having worked with him on several books, independently, my first novel had been published by Faber, and I asked him if I could write his biography with his total cooperation, but without his influence at all, and he agreed.
The book is not a typical biography by any means. I wondered at what stage you decided that you would become a character in it, and that the making of it would be presented up front, and all many of your thoughts or your misgivings or the trails you were following would be explicitly written about in the book.
That was decided right at the beginning, because I think anybody that knows Alistair personally or knows his work at all will understand why it doesn't seem to make sense to do a traditional dry academic biography of Alistair Gray. I was very aware right from the beginning of the process that many of the characters in the story, many of Alistair's closest friends and acquaintances and peers, were dying, and that I felt that the book needed to be done in a very messy, very involved way now, and not in a distant and dry way. That was also necessary because there's no point in me pretending to be entirely objective. As it happens, I don't believe in a complete objectivity for a biographer anyway. I think you either admit to your biases or hide them. There's no middle ground. But because of my relationship with Alistair, and because he had been so instrumental in teaching me to write, and had been almost like a family member that I'd looked up to hugely. There was no point in me pretending anything. I thought the best thing for me to do is to be totally honest about that and say, yes, I do look up to him. I do admire him. I do love him. Now let's get stuck into the work and see what's good and what isn't. And I'll try and explain why I think what I think and try and tell the story in the most entertaining way possible. So it had to be that right from the beginning. In terms of the layout, that came a little later. I'd always kept diary entries because things were continually happening with Alistair that I felt that I wanted to record anyway. But it became increasingly obvious as I was going on in the process that what I was trying to do and what I thought I could give that somebody in the future or that doesn't know Alistair so well can't give is access to what it's like to be in a room with him. You know, he's a remarkable personality, maddening and peculiar in many ways and full of tics, but fascinating. And I really think that Alistair Gray fans in 100 years are going to want to know what he was like to stand with. So I thought, this is how I should do this. I should do a diary entry about watching him paint or about watching him do events, readings, taking questions, publicising his latest novel, visiting him in hospital, driving him to a friend's funeral. These are the things where you can see the human being in a way that you can't when you're saying, and in 1992, Poor Things was published and it was received like this. So what I then had was these two strands going decade by decade in his life in a very traditional academic way and analysing the work in depth and praising some of it and criticising others and using the interviews that I'd done to embellish those and also interviews with Alistair. And then this other half, which was like the light relief in between all of the hard work of reading about, you know, his obscure poetry from the late 1980s that didn't do very well. I felt the balance between those two things was really important. And then it made sense to dovetail the two at the end. And instead of doing a traditional conclusion, to see where Alistair was up to in his life now. And that's as messy as any other stage.
Some of those scenes, as you say, have a sort of rich, absurd comedy to them. There's a moment where I think you're taking dictation and he gets up and urinates in the sink, which stuck in my mind.
Stuck in my mind as well. Although it was at that moment I thought, yes, here is a man who deserves my respect. But that was because he didn't pause in the dictation at the time. He, whilst urinating, continued to dictate the letter that he'd been dictating. So I think I say in the book, I don't think I ever, you know, washed my hands in that sink again. But I certainly thought, yes, here's a man who deserves my respect.
You're a novelist, as you say. I wondered how you did justice to the character that is Alistair Gray, or how you approached the question of doing justice to him without him becoming a caricature, because obviously there's a risk of that. I mean, you could simply fill a book full of anecdotes like that one. So how did you maintain his sort of reality and humanity at the same time as having this fund of stories that you could have simply regaled us with in those light and shade passages?
There definitely could have been another 100,000 words of pissing stories or fart stories, and that would have made him a caricature. But by spending any deal of time with Alistair, it's very obvious that his personality has many, many other deeper facets to it, and that he's not ignorant of the way that people see him. He's not stupid. So he, in fact, the opposite, the book argues that he's a great mind. So over the years, he's refined some of those personality tics in order to be able to get what he wants out of people as well, as anybody would do. And what I tried to do is to explore those darker sides as well in order to do him justice. That's more difficult for our relationship in general now, and I suppose, you know, for the future, because it's difficult for Alistair to read certain things. But I hope that I've done it in the most honest way that I can, and you have to show what he's like at his lowest, or else his highest doesn't mean anything. So I was very aware of turning him into this caricature that people would just laugh at. But there's one diary entry where I was introducing Alistair at an event, and then interviewed a number of people in the audience afterwards about how they perceived him. And it is interesting how some do think that he is just that caricature, but he knows what people see and plays up to that when he wants to and refuses to at other times. And if you spend a number of years with somebody paying attention, there are enough opportunities to see all of those sides. And it's an honest biographer's duty to show them all.
I think you say that interviewers, when they interview Alistair Gray, get a sort of one-man show, and there's still that presentation of himself. And you mentioned the voices that he does. And I wondered if you felt that you had kind of, by spending so much time close to him, you had kind of gone through all those layers and got to something that you really understood behind it about what made the man tick.
I think so to some extent, but I don't pretend to have done so any more than anyone else who's known him for many years. I mean, many of the people I interviewed have known Alistair for 30, 40, 50 years. And so I wouldn't pretend to know him as well as they do. But you certainly become aware of when certain voices are used and what that means. But it doesn't mean that Alistair was dishonest. I mean, on the contrary, he said that he feels that he's not afraid of this biography because he's faced the worst of what he's done and said in his life. And I think that's true. He doesn't mean very often to mislead. I'm talking about more subtle subconscious things that might be going on about ways to interact with the world. Alistair said in a self-portrait he wrote for the Saltire Society about 20 years ago, he wrote about all of those tics and honestly said, I think that I use them when I'm saying something that I really mean, but I'm afraid that people won't take seriously. There are defense mechanisms, social defense mechanisms that you sometimes see him repeating in events or in interviews or just in conversations. So I do think I've become familiar with, say, when he brings the gentleman of advancing years out of the drawer, or the wee Scotch laddie. But I don't pretend to know, to have got deeper to him than say, Liz Lockhead or Eleanor Hind or any of the people that have known him all his life.
And I wondered how your view of his writing changed and deepened, spending so much time researching his life and his writing and the reception of it. Did some books go up in your estimation and other books perhaps come down?
Yes, I suppose that is true. But because Alistair is such an autobiographical writer, to an extent, all writing, fact or fiction, I think, is a mix of the conscious and subconscious reminiscence and conscious and subconscious uses of imagination. And the Alistair's is so much more the autobiographical that you cannot help, when investigating his life, to go, ah, yes, there's a 50-page chapter of 1982 Janine that's literally straight from what has happened to him. That puts a different light on it. But I don't think it puts the books up or down in terms of quality. For example, Poor Things, which I think is one of Alistair's strongest works, at the end of the biography, I think I appreciate that more now, but that's the one that really has the least amount of him in it, at least in an obvious way. I think that's an example of him taking the greatest leaps of his imagination and taking a break from all of that autobiography. So the process does affect your opinions on the work, certainly. And you have less patience with the ones you don't like. You go, oh, for God's sake, here's another humorless intellectual falling in love with the first woman that he meets and then being miserable for the rest of his life. Not again, as it happens in some of Alistair's books.
Tell me a bit about the painting, because at one point, I can't remember if this is a quotation from him or from you, but he's described as a lucky jack of all trades. But I wondered to what extent his talents as a painter and as a writer have perhaps made it less easy for people to know exactly where, how to take him and what he is or what his place is in contemporary culture.
I think that the fact that he does so many things is what makes him unusual and fascinating and also hard to place, and that's made his life more difficult because people can't easily put him in a box, and that's difficult for publishing because they have to deal with him doing his artwork, and that's, they're not used to it. It's difficult for those digesting his art because it's so full of words, and it's difficult for those in poetry and plays and polemics and everything because he has been involved in all of these things, and no matter how much you press him, he won't admit to being more one than the other because he isn't. And that makes the whole story far more complicated. And I think it's definitely made it more difficult for him to be accepted. Yet, I think certain things are just taking a little while longer. For example, you mentioned the painting there. In the last 12 months, the main change that's happened with Alistair since I've finished the book is that he now has an international art agent who is finally making him money from his paintings, and he's 73. You know, it's just taken a while. But then it took a while with the writing as well. He was in his 50s by the time his first book came out, and it had taken him 30 years. So maybe that's just part of the pattern of long gestation periods. And I think the best of his work will survive, and people will always be confused by him and gone, yes, well, what is he really? But then that's a question that there's no point asking, I don't think. William Blake was both. He was both artist and poet, and so is Alistair. So is Rudyard Kipling, who was another huge influence on Alistair. But I don't think people are aware that these writers have existed in the past.
Would I be right in thinking, though, that you yourself were, or it had more uncertainty about what to make of the artwork as opposed to the writing? I sensed you were kind of looking around for some kind of external validation to sort of say, this is good, or this is not so good, or this is a place in modern art, or this is eccentric or whatever.
Absolutely. I admit that that's one of our major frustrations. The thing about being an Alistair Gray biographer is that whoever is the biographer, and there may be others in the future, please God, there'll be millions, they will all have a specialism, and my specialism is literature, and my appreciation for art is not exactly the same at the same level. I don't trust my instincts quite as much. So I admit that with the art, not the art that was mixed in with the literature, because that was easier to understand, but some of the portrait painting and some of the landscapes and those kind of things, I was looking around for external validation. And why? Because Alistair is not any more than a footnote anywhere. As I've just said, that's slightly changing now, but we're not just talking about European art or UK art, or even in Scottish art, even in modern Scottish art, Alistair is hardly mentioned in any of the books. It's really interesting to me that that's changing now. But I wrote this chapter, which was basically just a rant called Yes, Yes, But Is It Any Good? And it was really tough to find people who supported his artwork that either weren't already sympathetic to the literature, or mates, or ex-colleagues, or something, because Scotland is so small, the art community, that everybody knows each other. And that was frustrating, yes, because I felt like I did need a little bit of external validation in places. Yeah. But in the end, I had to concentrate more on the literature. I mean, this is a book that I promised Bloomsbury would be no more than 100,000 words. It's more like 150. He's written nearly 30 books in 73 years, and I've had to skip over them all. If I was going to deal with all the artwork as well, I mean, we'd be here for... I would lose everybody's attention, because you just couldn't do it. You couldn't write it in a book that you could actually hold with two hands.
And you're very honest about your own feelings about the man and how you want him... You don't just want to be allowed to admire him. You want him to admire you, and you want to be, you know, that you want to be recognised, I suppose. And when there's a moment in the book when you're replaced as his secretary, and you feel quite hurt about that, and you can sort of understand it. But I wondered, was it difficult to judge that right, that the amount to which you would show your own feelings about those little everyday things, and the amount of attention that you received from him, and the project received?
I thought that was the very least I could do, was to be honest about those feelings that I had, because I'm delving into so many of his. People would see through me immediately if I tried to pretend that I didn't have an ego of my own. I would be the first person not to have one. I so therefore admit that I enjoyed getting close to Alistair and wanted to continue to be, and still want to continue to be, and I have great affection for him. And I didn't want my analysing and criticising his entire existence to get in the way of that. But with the secretary thing, that was slightly different, because me becoming a fiction writer was totally independent of Alistair. He never helped me with anything in terms of trying to get an agent or a publisher or that side of things. And when I just didn't have the time for it anymore, I was kind of kidding myself that I still had the time to be his secretary, but I didn't, because I was then a writer myself, and I had to find a way to continue to be that and also maintain a relationship with Alistair. Partly because I was writing this book about him. But I felt it would just be lies to pretend that I didn't care about it. Any of the criticism has to be seen in context of everything else. And I'm really bad at lying anyway. I just think it was best for me to just put it all down. And many of those diary entries were just written in the spirit of whatever emotion I had at that very second. And if the book has any worth, I think that's a big part of it. And so, although I would very much like to have removed the email I sent to Alistair drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning telling him how much I loved him, I can't really, because the whole thing would just read as sanitized. And intelligent readers would say, there's something missing here.
And was writing this book in a way part of your own maturing as a writer and discovering what kind of writer you were too?
I hope so. Alistair's been such a big part of the beginning of my writing. Well, I hope it will be the beginning. It might be the end. Depends how this one's received. But I felt like I needed to address that and then move on from it. And so it feels like an important milestone for me in my writing, and it's forced me to grow up a lot. It's also forced me to pay attention to facts and to try and do justice by real people. Whereas when you're writing novels, it's extremely freeing, but you have no responsibility to anybody. And so it gave me a sense of responsibility, I think, because I felt I have to do this justice in the best way that I can.
Let me ask you finally, presumably one of the outcomes you hope the book will have is that people go back and read the work or discover the work for the first time. And I wondered what you would say to somebody who has never dipped a toe into the water, where best to start with Alistair Gray's writing.
The one that I always recommend to people who have no context for Alistair or don't know his work at all is Poor Things, because I think that's the most fun. I think it has all of the elements of the flavour of Glasgow that's always so important in Alistair's work, but it doesn't keep readers away. It invites people in, and also because it has elements of gothic and pastiche and trying so many different flavours at the same time. I think that's the most easy to get at, but not it's not shallow in any way. It's a deeply satisfying, rich book, and much of Alistair's best work has come as a surprise to him, and Poor Things came out of nowhere. He was writing a short story book he wasn't really interested in at the time, and as he said, it swole up enormous without his permission, which is always a great sign. It meant that he was just doing it for fun, and you can see the fun on the page. And that's the one I always recommend for starters.
And is Lanark the one that in decades to come will be on lists of great Scottish books, do you think?
I think the momentum is behind Lanark in a way that the others would find hard to catch up with. But again, I find this stuff interesting. The reception to 1982 Janine has definitely changed in recent years since it was republished as a Canongate classic about 5 years ago. The attitude to it was very negative at the beginning, but I think it's, in many ways, it's his strongest, most powerful work. It's most difficult in a way as well, but I hope that that's the one that is remembered. I think Poor Things, because it was the most popular, also has a chance. But even very great writers struggle to be remembered for more than one book. And if it's Lanark, then that's okay, because that's the book that he always wanted to write before he died, and it took him most of his life to write it. And once he'd finished it, he didn't quite know what to do, because he felt he'd achieved what he wanted to. So perhaps that is right, that it will be Lanark.
I was talking to Rog Glass about his Life of Alistair Gray, a secretary's biography, which is available now in hardback. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you have, you can subscribe free at iTunes. Just type Podularity in the search box, and you'll never miss a future episode again. Until next time, thank you for listening. And goodbye.